Hello and welcome to Undivided. I'm Brandi Cruz. On this Friday before Election Day, if you have not got your ballots in already, if you have not voted already, if your state allows for early voting or mail-in voting, this weekend's a great time to do that. We're going to be talking about elections for the entirety of the show today, including some topics that you guys have wanted me to touch on. One of those is why so many, at least in Washington state, of the judicial races are unopposed. There's, you know, Supreme Court justices, for instance, that are running without any opponent whatsoever. And given the gravity of those jobs and the decisions that they make, it just seemed odd to some voters. It seems odd to me as well. And so we're going to be joined by a King County Superior Court judge who's going to offer some insight as to why so many judicial races only have one person on the ballot. Also, we've been kind of putting a pause to some of the fun things we do on Fridays because we have so much election stuff to discuss. But we are going to have an edition of Florida Report today with my sister Miranda because there are some interesting things afoot when it comes to elections in the state of Florida. Also, Washington State's youngest senator is going to join us on the show today to not only talk about the campaign that he's currently in the midst of, but I just wanted to get his thoughts on the future of politics in Washington State and in our country. As I'm going to start the show talking about today, things have gotten particularly nasty. Dishonesty is worse than ever in political campaigns. And so given the fact that this is his first official campaign ever, I wanted to get his thoughts as someone new to the political arena on the state of things and on the direction of things. So we'll have Senator Simon Sefcik on shortly. But first, I talked about dishonesty on the show on Monday. I think, in fact, it was the headline of the show, it was the title of the show. And as I mentioned then, dishonesty can come in a lot of different forms. Dishonesty can be a blatant lie. Dishonesty can be something that bends the truth or something that lacks context. But dishonesty, when it's truly, truly deceitful, can be something that's rooted in the truth, but presented with dishonest motivations. And I have an example of that for you today. We've talked on the show about the Secretary of State's race in Washington. This is the person who's going to be in charge of elections. Now, Republicans have held that seat, had held that seat for decades, until in 2020, our Republican Secretary of State, Kim Wyman, she won the election, and then she stepped down to take a job in the Biden administration. And so it gave Democrats this open door to capture a seat that they've been trying to capture for years. But this race has become particularly interesting because the two people who made it past the primary election are Democrat Steve Hobbs, who was appointed by Governor Jay Inslee to be in that position after Kim Wyman left, and a nonpartisan candidate, Julie Anderson. Julie Anderson is currently the auditor in Pierce County, Washington, and I've said on this show that she is undoubtedly the most qualified person for the job. She probably should have been appointed by Governor Inslee, but I believe that Governor Inslee appointed Senator Steve Hobbs because Steve Hobbs is a moderate Democrat and Governor Inslee wanted him out of the Senate, so he gave him this job instead. Now, I have nothing against Steve Hobbs. Like I said, I think when it comes to Democrats in Olympia, he was one of the most fair-minded of them. He was a moderate for sure, and he didn't have a problem speaking out against his own party. And so among all the hyper-partisan politicians that I'm concerned about, Steve Hobbs is certainly not in that book for me. But that being said, I just don't think he's qualified for the job. I mean, surely you could learn the job, but for me, at least, Julie Anderson is undoubtedly the most qualified person, and she has support from people on both sides of the political aisle. Republicans are supporting her. Some of her longtime Democratic colleagues are supporting her. So something really interesting is happening in this race. So there is a Republican, Brad Klippert, who is mounting a write-in campaign. And there are, you know, members of the state party who are encouraging this. Now, I like Brad Klippert. I think he's a fine guy. I appreciate his service as a member of law enforcement. But he can't win. He cannot win a write-in campaign. Write-in campaigns are incredibly difficult, no matter who's doing it. And so that's just a non-starter. So all this is really going to serve to do, and I guess I don't know the motivation of the state Republican Party in not trying to quash this. I realize they're about to lose a seat they've held for a very long time, but they're not going to win it with a write-in campaign. They failed to get this seat because they ran too many people in the primary, split the vote, and it sent through a Democrat and a nonpartisan. So, you know, they made their bed and they should lie in it, not try to mount a write-in campaign that's not going to be successful. But what this write-in campaign does is it gives Steve Hobbs a lifeline. So like I said, if you're a Republican and you're choosing between Democrat Steve Hobbs and nonpartisan Julie Anderson, you're probably going to go with the nonpartisan. So I thought that Julie Anderson was for sure going to win the November election, that it was a no-brainer. But now when you add in the complication of a Republican writing a campaign, then you start to have some Republican votes that might be siphoned away from Julie Anderson. And Democrats are counting on that now. And they are trying to leverage that in what I believe is a very dishonest way. So Governor Jay Inslee and the chair of the Washington State Democratic Party, Tina Podlodowski, they put out a joint video. And the headline that they put it out under on Twitter says, "We must do everything we can to keep MAGA Republican and election deniers from threatening the integrity and security of Washington's voting process. Want to make sure your friends and family have accurate information about the election? Show them this video. Our democracy is at stake." And in this video, the governor and the head of the state Democratic Party are talking about how dangerous Brad Clippert is and telling people they must not write Brad Clippert's name in. Watch.
Well, Steve Hobbs has proven himself to be a terrific Secretary of State. And as a couple of the state's top Democrats, we're proud to support him. As your Secretary of State, Steve has established an information response team that is fighting back against MAGA Republican misinformation and disinformation campaigns that really seeks to suppress voter turnout. Now, another candidate for Secretary of State, MAGA Republican Brad Clippert. Brad Clippert is one of the worst peddlers of this election disinformation in Washington State. So whatever you do, do not write in Brad Clippert for Secretary of State.
That's right. Brad Clippert has peddled conspiracy theories about how Trump won the 2020 election. And Brad Clippert wants to completely abolish Washington State's convenient and secure mail-in voting system, the system that's become a model for the nation. If, God forbid, Brad Clippert wins, not only will he undo the great work that Steve Hobbs is doing to combat disinformation, Brad Clippert will use the office to promote conspiracy theories and disenfranchise diverse voters. That's what's on the ballot in this election.
So look, we want to be very clear. The only Republican in the race, writing candidate Brad Clippert, has put democracy on the line. So we've got to send a message to the rest of the country that Washington voters will not let anyone interfere with our state's successful, secure, and sacred voting processes. That's why we're urging everyone to vote for Steve Hobbs. We must do everything we can to defeat Republican Brad Clippert and his wacky conspiracy theories. And they are wacky with no support or evidence whatsoever. So we want to repeat, whatever you do, do not write in Brad Clippert. And get your ballots in Tuesday, November 8th. Go Democrats, go Hawks, and go democracy in our state.
Here's the thing. Governor Inslee and Tina Podlodowski know damn well that Brad Clippert isn't going to win. They also know that by the two of them telling people don't write Brad Clippert's name in, that a lot of Republicans are going to see that and be like, screw you, I'm writing Brad Clippert's name in. But what this is reverse psychology. Again, they know Brad Clippert's not going to win, but they're saying, coming out strongly against him, telling people not to vote for him, to try to get Republicans to vote for him. And they know that that will siphon votes away from Julie Anderson. So it's not that they're really concerned about Brad Clippert and his our democracy being at stake, because they know Brad won't win. But they are concerned about their Democratic candidate, Steve Hobbs, not winning. And so by doing this, using a little reverse psychology, they're hoping to trick Republican voters into essentially throwing their vote away by casting it for a write-in candidate who has no chance.
So we want to repeat, whatever you do, do not write in Brad Clippert.
And this goes, again, into this deep dishonesty. And they're leveraging it using people's fear. Again, saying, want to make sure your friends and family have accurate information about the election? Show them this video. Our democracy is at stake. So they're hoping that folks will send this to their family and friends that are Republicans, encouraging them, hey, don't vote for Brad Clippert. The governor doesn't want you to vote for Brad Clippert, so that they'll go out and vote for Brad Clippert. Don't be fooled by that. Now, look, I'll never tell you who to vote for. I don't do individual endorsements of candidates, although I've been very clear that I think Julie Anderson is the most qualified. So I think that tells you who I'm voting for in the race. And if you really want to vote for Brad Klippert, fine. I'm not going to tell you that you can't or shouldn't do a write-in. Do what you want to do. Do what you feel like is right. Vote for someone who you believe in. But I will tell you that every Republican vote that Brad Klippert gets puts Democrats one step closer to getting their candidate in office, to winning the seat that they've wanted to win all along. And I believe the result will be putting in someone who's a Governor Jay Inslee appointee, who's a nice guy, don't get me wrong, who is a moderate, don't get me wrong, but who is clearly the less qualified person for the job. And that's bothersome to me. Because again, it all is going to come down to letters next to people's names, as opposed to Julie Anderson, who's been doing this work for years, who took a chance at running without the backing of a major party, and who I think, frankly, deserves to win. One of the things that's always really disturbing to me during elections is the outright vilification of certain voting blocs. We saw it with President Biden and his vilification of quote-unquote MAGA Republicans. I've said before that I think, as opposed to vilifying them, you look at, you know, tens of millions of people who voted for Donald Trump, you as the president should be trying to figure out why. Why did they go with Donald Trump and not with our candidates? What can we do to better serve them so that they'll vote for us in the future? But instead, you just go out and vilify them. And I don't think that's productive for Democrats. And I don't think it's productive for our country. I want to play you a clip that was really disturbing. And it aired on The View. And look, The View, I mean, I don't know if they just like are desperate for the ratings and the money that is generated, so they put like the craziest person on their lineup. But Sonny Hostin was talking about how white suburban women are going to be voting. And this is what she said.
I read a poll just yesterday that white Republican suburban women are now going to vote Republican.
Why?
It's almost like roaches voting for Raid, right?
It's insulting to the voter.
And I'll just stop and point out that the woman who's pushing back is co-host Alyssa Farah Griffin, who worked in communications for the Trump administration.
Voting against their own self-interest. Do they want to live in Gilead?
Okay, do we love democracy or not? Because just saying that it's insulting to the voter. People make up decisions on what's right for their family. And the idea that you should have a say for everyone else's vote.
The fact that women are voting against
their own
health care.
You had a different view on abortion not that long ago. And I have that view. But that issue is
right.
But then why is another woman not able to have a different view?
That white Republican suburban women.
But why have you so recently evolved on the issue?
So what's interesting, and you hear it kind of there, is Sonny Hostin, not too long ago, her view on abortion was, she admitted, on the extreme end. She said, like right after the Roe decision, that she is vehemently opposed to abortion in any circumstance, including in cases of rape and incest. And it surprised a lot of her panelists because she's clearly like this progressive woman on so many issues. And again, she said just a few months ago that she's absolutely opposed to abortion in any instance. And now she's saying in this video, oh, well, white women are voting for Republicans and it's going to turn the nation into Gilead, which, of course, is the fictional nation in Handmaid's Tale. And what Farah Griffin points out is, you know, you've evolved your view on abortion. And now you're vilifying women who vote for politicians who had a view similar to yours? Why are you allowed to have that view, but they're not allowed to have that view?
You had a different view on abortion not that long ago, and you evolved on it.
I have that view.
But that issue is
right.
But then why is another woman not able to have a different view?
That white Republican suburban women.
But why have you so recently evolved on the issue?
So there's a couple things in there that bother me, but it's really, I mean, it's definitely not something that you just see on The View. I think it happens to us in our day-to-day lives, and that's this vilification of people based on their political preferences, like the inability to see them as individual humans with independent thought. And if they're not voting the way that you're voting, then they must be just awful people. And I think that permeates our culture in America way too much. And it also permeates, you know, Hollywood and television and the way that, you know, you can have Sonny Hostin calling people who are voting for Republicans these women cockroaches. And it's like if you had on a talk show someone who said the opposite, who called people voting for progressives cockroaches, I mean, I just don't think that it would be received in the same way. So I just think that we need to get to a place where we can focus our energy on trying to understand why people vote the way they do and trying to appeal to them based on their needs, as opposed to vilifying people and trying to shame them into voting a different way. I've tried to avoid too much coverage on the podcast of hyperlocal races because I always want the podcast to be relevant to as many of you as possible. But there is a few legislative races in Washington State that I've been talking about. One of them was that ongoing crazy situation in the 10th Legislative District with a Democrat who lied about his military service, who lied about his about being a lawyer. Clyde Shaver is his name. He had his endorsement. He was endorsed by the Everett Herald. They pulled that endorsement and endorsed instead his Republican challenger, the person who currently holds that seat, Republican Greg Gilday. I talked a lot about that on the show on Monday. But I also wanted to talk about a race for the 42nd Legislative District for senator. So this was a seat held by the late Senator Doug Erickson, who died late in 2021 after a battle with COVID-19. So what happened after Senator Erickson died is there was a process to put someone in his position until the next election. And the person who was chosen was Republican, now State Senator Simon Sefcik, who became the youngest state senator in Washington state history. He is now officially campaigning to continue to hold that seat in the 42nd district. And I invited him on the show, yes, to talk about his campaign a little bit. But given all the conversations we've been having about the sad state of politics, about how nasty these campaigns are, about how lie-ridden they are, about how divisive they are, I wanted to get his thoughts as someone who's very new to the political arena, someone who I believe is going to be in it for a very long time in the state of Washington, about kind of the state of politics and about the direction that he sees it going. Senator, welcome to Undivided.
Thanks for having me, Brandy.
You know, I do want to talk about your campaign, obviously. We're just a couple days out, but I also just was curious to get your thoughts sort of on, you know, your first true election experience given the state of politics and how nasty things have gotten. What surprised you about what it's like to run a full-blown campaign?
Well, you know, as you mentioned, this is a full-blown campaign. I think we saw that the combined numbers for my race up here and my opponent combined will be more than $3 million spent. And so it's a bloodbath up here. And I get that question, you know, has this process, especially in this time, made you more cynical about the process or those sorts of things? Because, you know, like you mentioned, this was my first time doing anything like this. You know, I'd never raised money for a political campaign or cause before or anything like that. But in reality, it has done the opposite. Despite, in my opinion, all of the dangers and all of the demonization that occurs oftentimes on both sides, it has made me more hopeful about our process. And the answer, in my opinion, is because when we get out of sort of the echo chamber, and when you talk to common hopes that share common dreams with different people, you know, when you talk to the person on their front porch or in their backyard in a VFW hall at a Sikh temple, you know, that's where you really see what America is supposed to be. And to me, it's actually given me a lot more hope that even regardless of what happens, I do think our better days are ahead of us. But that sense of community has to be the core of who we are.
Obviously, your age has always been at the top of the list of conversation things for you. And are you 23 now?
22.
Oh, you're still 20. Were you 21 when you took that seat?
No, I was 22. My birthday is next month. Next month, December 21st.
Gotcha.
I always hated that birthday growing up as a kid, obviously, because of how close it was to Christmas. But yes, I'm a December baby.
So 22, how much has your age come up on the campaign trail as you've been speaking to voters?
You know, I think it comes up a decent amount, mainly at the door. I think when people have heard about me, but I knock at the door and they go, oh, you're younger than I thought you were. And I really think it's an asset more than it is a liability. And the reason is just because I think people are eager for something that's fresh, something that's new, something that's exciting. And my request with people has always been, don't shy away from asking me the tough questions. ask me the same questions you would ask any other candidate, because I believe that I will hold up and actually outshine, you know, my opponent based on my merit, not because of my age. And so, yeah, you know, I may not have as many birthdays as some other people, but what I do have and what I do believe is a new sense of energy and of empathy that's desperately needed down in Olympia.
Talk about that a little more, because you said, you know, because of my age, you see it as an asset, bring some fresh perspectives. What are some things that you might have a different perspective on as someone who's 22, as opposed to folks in Olympia already who are maybe in their 40s, 50s or 60s?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of things. You know, one of the top issues for me is housing. And that's just because as a young person, it's very easy to talk about affordable housing. I'm living, you know, some of the crisis that we're seeing in Whatcom County, where I am, and throughout the state. Young people that have grown up here, their families are here, that want to be able to purchase and own a home someday and are just getting priced out of a market because of policies down in Olympia and at our city level sometimes that make no sense. And so, you know, tackling a lot of these challenges, when I think sometimes there's a tendency, and something I did notice sort of when I went down to Olympia that I will say was on both sides, is that you have Republicans that are wary of Democrats just because, well, in the past, this Democrat did this to me. And so, you know, we're not going to co-sponsor their bill this time. And you have Democrats that do the same exact thing, or, you know, Democrats that they may have this sort of belief that, well, if a Republican has an amendment that they've added to a bill, it must be some sort of poison amendment. And it's like, no, oftentimes these amendments genuinely just improve the quality of the bill. But there's this sort of suspicion that I think surrounds both sides, unfortunately, that the other side has to be pulling a fast one. And I think that's deeply unfortunate.
One of the conversations you and I had when you were first appointed to the seat is, like I said at the time, something my dad used to call the pressures of mature life. And while you are obviously a very mature and intelligent 22-year-old who could hold a conversation with anyone, you are still 22. And I think there are things you experience in your 30s and 40s that are the pressures of mature life that only someone of that age can understand. Are there any detriments to being a 22-year-old senator in your estimation?
Oh, that I've never had somebody word the question that way. But I mean, yeah, I would, you know, when people are skeptical about me, I think, or initially because of my age, I fully acknowledge that's a reasonable sort of suspicion. You know, I'm not going to pretend that this is something that is normal. But what I've said is, you know, you judge me by the same metrics that you judge anybody else by, which ultimately in this country should be the quality of my ideas and the content of my character. And so certainly I may not have some of those life experiences that other people may have, but I bring a different set of skills to the table in my estimate. And, you know, in the same way that many of the founders, even in early American time, were far younger. You know, I think sometimes we look back and we sort of imagine that the founding fathers were, you know, men with gray beards and gray hair, but most of them were actually quite young because it was their battle and they were fighting for their future. And in the same way, I think there's millions of people across this country that feel that same sense of energy and enthusiasm. And so, yeah, it's true. Like I say, if I could snap my fingers and have more birthdays and be older, I wouldn't even take you up on the offer. But certainly, I think it's different, but I think it actually makes me better able to listen and to learn. And I think that's one of the biggest strengths, you know, is the acknowledgement, the recognition that I do not pretend to be an expert on a lot of these issues. You know, I don't pretend to be a law enforcement expert, for example. But what I do promise to do is listen to those that are in law enforcement, hear their concerns, and be able to deliver that with a voice down in Olympia. And I think that's what I've done and that's what I want to do. You know, I think all the time of even folks like Abraham Lincoln, you know, grew up in the backwoods of Kentucky. He was never supposed to rise to the political heights that he did. And yet he showed us that there's power in passion and there's power in our convictions. And that's what I think I bring to the table.
People thought the founding fathers were older than they were because some of them wore those silly gray wigs, you know, so they just aged themselves.
Well, you know, I've gotten different advice on like whether I should grow a beard or something like that to look older, but I can't grow a very good beard. So, you know, maybe I'll try the wig out and see if that helps.
Please don't. One of the other interesting aspects of this race is that your challenger, Representative Sharon Shoemake, chose you, right? Right.
Well, she was not part of the group that appointed me. So the way it works is the county council in Whatcom County here is the group that appointed me. But she did provide, according to public records requests that were done to your point, she did provide input, calling me the best choice actually for the position in order to get appointed. And, you know, I think there's a lot of speculation as to why that is, but candidly, I think it's because she thought that I would not be a very good candidate. You know, I think that she maybe thought that I wouldn't hold her accountable for her record and what I feel has been a disastrous voting record for the people of the 42nd district. And so I think she picked me because I was the underdog, and I acknowledge that I'm the underdog. And yet we've seen the incredible momentum that this campaign has built because people are desiring returning affordability, restoring public safety, and rebuilding accountability. That's a winning message. And, you know, to those of you maybe that are listening or watching that don't know the dynamic of the district up here, it's been a pretty heated race. My opponent have been at each other in our debates pretty publicly. And I'm not going to apologize for that. I will not apologize for calling out what I believe is a record that does not represent the views of the vast majority of people in my district or even in Washington State. And, you know, I think that that's my job as a legislator is to call out what I feel is a poor voting record from my opponent.
What do you think is one of the fundamental differences between the two of you?
Public safety and more specifically drug policies. I mean, to give you an example, one of the Democratic seatmates that I have is Representative Alicia Rule. She's a Democrat, and her and I agree on most of these public safety things. We both actually worked in the legislative session, and she worked on a bill actually to make possession of fentanyl a felony, because fentanyl is one of the most dangerous drugs out there right now. And my opponent, her seatmate, again, fellow Democrats, disagree on that. My opponent does not believe any possession of any hard drug should be treated as a felony. And I just think that is not in the vast majority of favorable opinion, again, amongst both Democrats and Republicans and just general people in the state of Washington. That is extraordinarily extreme in my view.
Abortion has been a tricky subject for Republicans to message around. Make clear your stance on abortion for me, Senator.
Yeah, well, I've always said, and I think you asked me this question even back several months ago, that I believe in the value and the sanctity of all human life. And I understand that there are extremes on both sides. This is a difficult conversation. I don't pretend to know or understand the full complexities of it. I don't have any children, for example. But what I do know is that the people of Washington have been clear so far about this issue, and I don't anticipate that changing anytime soon. What I do anticipate changing, and the areas where I think we can make a big change in, are those areas that I talked about: affordability, public safety, accountability. And so, you know, my job as an elected official is to represent the views of the state of Washington, the views of the district, and also to be realistic about the areas that can be impacted for change. And, you know, the vast majority of people that I hear from, you know, even if they're concerned about the abortion issue, when it actually comes to things that they think will change in the state of Washington, they're worried why the homeless problem continues to grow and all of those sorts of things. And that's what's on their mind. That's what's on my mind.
Quickly, though, on the abortion thing, you said it's not something that you foresee changing anytime soon, and short of a national abortion ban or restriction, I agree with you. But is it something you would like to see changed in Washington, the law as it exists?
I think that the law in the state of Washington has gone too far in several categories. You know, and I'll give you an example. One of those came from this legislative session. That was House Bill 1851 that basically expanded who can provide abortion services beyond a physician, which is actually what the people of Washington originally approved. And it expanded it to advanced registered nurse practitioners. It expanded it to anybody operating under the scope of practice of an ARNP, which was 33 medical categories under the Department of Health that was not even defined in the statute. And so that's just an example that expands who can provide those services to what I think actually ends up being unsafe for women at times. And so this is far beyond the general category of safe, legal, and rare to at times what may end up being unsafe. There was even an amendment that was provided during that debate to say, well, if there's a in operation that occurs in the case of medical negligence, you should be allowed to sue the person conducting that service. And the majority party voted against that. So, I mean, we're talking about undefined medical categories that can now perform these services. And if something goes wrong, you can't necessarily sue for medical negligence. That to me is far outside of the mainstream.
I appreciate the example. But as you mentioned, you know, abortion is not the key issue. You're hearing from folks up there. You mentioned homelessness. To what extent has that crisis seeped into the 42nd?
It's heartbreaking, Brandy. You know, I've done ride-alongs now with nearly every police department in my county here. And I've been behind some of the homeless camps. There are some that I'm not allowed to go to. The police office told me basically that they will not take me unless they have four officers and a canine unit. To go back there. And so we have, you know, there's all sorts of estimates. At one point, there was an estimate that around 150 people, you know, were behind a Walmart, which I know to those of you maybe that are watching from Seattle, that may not sound like a lot. My district is a traditionally fairly sort of a rural area. And that's a huge sort of new thing that we've seen in the last few years. We are not used to experiencing what some of you have in Seattle and Tacoma. And my goal is for us to not experience those things. But, you know, it's heartbreaking first because of the crime associated with it. We're talking about retail theft that goes unpunished, but also from more importantly, just the humanity of it. We're talking about people that are killing themselves, you know, behind a Walmart, killing themselves in the street using a lethal drug. And the only thing, I mean, I went on a ride along, an individual only a few years older than myself, you know, smoking fentanyl in broad daylight. And the only thing a police officer could do standing there watching the whole thing was provide a little warning card with a number to call. Nobody can tell me with a serious face that that is a compassionate response. I mean, we are killing people in the name of kindness, and it's shameful. And so that's why I think, you know, we need to make sure that these people get help. And that involves having consequences to your action, because some of these people are so far gone into an addiction that they are not going to voluntarily call that number, that they need an intervention. And that's why the Blake decision and our drug statutes right now have made this problem.
If you could snap your fingers, there's an upcoming session, let's say that you win and you get to keep your seat. You know, don't consider whether it could get the support to pass. But when it comes to the homelessness crisis specifically, if you could push something through on your own, what would that singular idea be?
If I could push something through on my own, it can only be one thing. I mean, it would be several sort of comprehensive approach. But first, we have to address our drug statutes. Secondly, we do need to expand our supply of affordable housing, but that does not just mean sticking people in tiny homes. It means having methods of accountability so that you're addressing sometimes the underlying mental health issues or drug issues. I don't believe that simply locking every homeless person up, you know, that's addicted to drugs is going to fix these problems. But I do think providing more services that actually come with accountability, like's been done in other states, is a comprehensive way to do that. And that means, again, I think giving people a diversion option to where they may get arrested, for example, and have the option to go to jail or to go to a facility where they can get clean. And if they do that successfully, then it may stay off their record. Those sorts of approaches, I think, are going to be helpful. In terms of housing policy generally, too, I mean, nearly a quarter of all housing costs, according to the BIAW, come from permitting fees alone. I mean, think about that. To the people that, you know, are sick of the housing market, a quarter of the cost of your home just comes from paying for more fees and taxes. That doesn't make any sense.
I mentioned the upcoming session. In anticipation of that session, are there any bills that you have already planned on introducing or working toward?
You know, we're working right now on the vehicular pursuit issue and some of those drug statutes. And so I fully anticipate us being bringing up the issue regarding vehicular pursuits again. Obviously, we're going to have a big conversation about the long-term care tax. Folks, gas prices are expected to go up around starting at 46 cents in January. And so all those sorts of things that I think we're going to be taking a comprehensive look at. I think some of these, quite frankly, like the vehicular pursuit issue, I'd be happy to sponsor a bill about that. But I would actually like to see a Democrat take the lead on it, because A, they are the ones that caused the problem. I want to be very clear about that. But secondly, we do need a bipartisan consensus on that. And we need to work with each other.
Yeah, I agree. And I've heard a lot of Democrats, you know, all of a sudden kind of take this interest in public safety. And I hope that it lasts past November 8th. I'm not super confident, but I hope that it does. Simon, let's end with this. As we've been talking on the podcast a lot lately, to me, this is one of the most dishonest election cycles I've ever seen. I've been, and it's hard to surprise me, but I've been truly surprised by some of the campaign ads, the campaign literature that has gone out. Is there something that you feel like has been floated about you that you think isn't fair? If there is, do you want to correct the record on it?
Oh, wow. You know, those are questions I think every political candidate loves. Like you mentioned, maybe this is the nastiest campaign you've seen. This is sort of the first one that I've seen. So for me, this is normal. But yeah, you know, when you see $500,000 being spent, you know, against you with all sorts of claims, that's always eye opening. To me, you know, one of the most fascinating claims I keep hearing is that supposedly I am not a supporter of law enforcement because I voted against the budget. And in the budget, that included funding to go to basic operations, which includes law enforcement. So even though I'm endorsed by every single law enforcement organization in the state that does endorsements and our local law enforcement groups, supposedly I'm the enemy of law enforcement when my opponent is the one who voted for every single one of these laws that handicap them. And to me, that really is the frustrating thing, because you're right, Brandy, when the spotlight is on, when there's money in an election cycle, candidates will do anything and say anything in order to get elected. And so we are seeing all of these candidates that voted to handicap and handcuff law enforcement now turning around acting like they're the heroes. But when the confetti gets swept away and when the lights get dimmed, the question is whether those leaders that caused the problems will have the courage and the willingness to own up to it and to actually work to fix it. And quite frankly, I am not optimistic that if we keep electing the same people that caused the problem, I'm not sure that means we'll be able to find a solution. And that's why I do think that we need new leadership in the state.
Yeah, it's a level of gaslighting that's pretty troubling. And I think it shows a low opinion of voters, too, that you would try to fool them in that way instead of just running on your record. Well, Senator Simon Sefcik, good luck to you. And we'll see how Tuesday goes.
Thank you very much, Brandy. Appreciate it.
I did a live Q&A the other day with Undivided subscribers, as we do at the end of every single month. And one of the questions I got a lot was, why are there so many judicial races on our ballots that are unopposed, where you only have one choice, or I guess you can write someone's name in? And that strikes me, too, because especially with the state of the criminal justice system, having the right judge in the job is incredibly important. You hear all these stories about like woke judges letting people out with almost no bail or no bail at all, and the impact that can have. And then you look at the state Supreme Court, you know, we get elect judges for the state, justices for the state Supreme Court. Those are such important positions. And so it's disappointing, I guess, to see so many of these judicial races where there is no opponent for you to choose from. So I reached out to King County Superior Court Judge Sean O'Donnell and asked him to come on the show to talk a little bit about what's going on here. Judge O'Donnell, welcome to Undivided.
Thanks for having me.
Do I call you Your Honor? That's appropriate, right? Your Honor, welcome to Undivided.
Whatever you're most comfortable with. People say, hey, you, Sean, Judge, I've seen the whole mix.
I'm not going to say, hey, you. I won't get there yet. But I appreciate you coming on. As I told you when I reached out, I got a lot of questions and continue to get questions from folks who are going to fill out their ballot, who are wondering why so many of the judicial races are just one person. They don't have another option. Give me the, I don't know if the answer is easy, but why is that?
So I've got a two-part response to this question. And I love it that people are wanting to know and that they care about the third branch of government, because they should. I don't have to tell you, it's super important. We make such consequential decisions, whether it's on an individual's life or for policy reasons. And I'd also preference my response today by just telling you, the job I hold, I love what I do. I feel very blessed to be a judge in Washington State. The answer to your question, though, is twofold. And I'll start with first is, you know, who would want to be a judge? And I frame it to you this way, because obviously you have to be a lawyer, right? So that winnows the field. And then from there, you know, there's a recognition and to put it plainly, this is hard work. I mean, the decisions that we make as judges are, they can be momentous in people's lives. And there is a ton of stress that can carry with that. And, you know, the notion that at 5 o'clock you roll home and aren't thinking about the cases that you've had before you is wrong. We have to know, like, and I'm a superior court judge, so trial level. But, you know, there are like 91 different titles of the RCWs, the Revised Code of Washington. And at some point, they're going to be in our mix. So whether it's mortgages or murder or a parenting plan or noxious weeds or probate, I mean, this is all in the mix of things that we're asked to decide. The legislature, they make changes to the laws every year. Things are moving quickly in that regard. And I mentioned stress, but, you know, compared to the federal courts, like trial judges, you know, a federal court district court judge, which is a federal trial judge, they probably have 4 law clerks that are helping them research and write the opinion and review briefings. We've got nothing in that department at the state level. So it's like a one man, one person shop. Typical judge has about 350 plus cases assigned to them. And as I said, the ability to process through that and get through that, it is a lot of work. It's stressful work. You know, there's another reality too about this job. It's very public. And if we stumble, you know, people know it. And whether it's the litigants or the lawyers on their listservs or the media, and you know, we all know that coming into the job, but that adds to the stress. There's another reality about this job, and you know, you hear about politicians who are threatened. You know, unfortunately, judges get too many threats. I mean, I've had colleagues who have had people unhappy with their decisions, protesting in front of their houses. I've had threats to shoot me in the head. Other judges have too. Some unscrupulous litigants will put liens against a judge's property. And, you know, that's all part of the mix of the job. And the other part of it, and I say this, again, deep respect for the position I hold, very grateful for it. But if you compare where judges sit in terms of others in the legal profession for pay structure, like the lawyers with 15 to 20 years experience are billing out probably between $450 and $700 an hour.
Yeah.
And, you know, a question to them is, well, why don't you want to be a judge? And you probably know the answer to that. So that's part A to my response. And let me pause there. And if you have any, if you want to follow up on any of that, I'm happy to answer.
I was definitely curious about the pay element of it. And just to clarify, and correct me if I'm getting the process wrong, the process is if there is a vacancy, the governor appoints someone to fill the vacancy?
And yeah, then... Well,
yeah, tell me about the process to become a judge, because I know that the governor can do some appointments, but then there are elections.
Well, that's the second part of my answer, right?
Oh, go ahead. Okay, let's do it.
The first part is, like, who would want to be a judge? Right. It's a very niche area of work. You got to love trials. You got to love public service. You got to love being in court, the unpredictability and the stress that has to be in your wheelhouse. And that really narrows the field of folks who want to do that. A lot of lawyers who will tell you, if I never set a day in court, I will be a happy person. And, you know, that's their wheelhouse. So you have a natural calling of, given the type of work, then the process of running. I ran in a contested race that was 10 years ago to get my position. And I can tell you, it is expensive. You give up 8 months of your life for an uncertain result. And You are constantly on the go. Now judges are in this weird position. Like if I'm running for United States Senate, I can go out to 100 different fundraisers and say, give me money. Judges can't ask for money. What we have to do is rely on friends and family and put together what we call fundraising committees. So you get maybe 10 or 15 people. They say, look, I got to raise money for this race. Would you go out and help me? Now, just think that through for a second. That's a hard lift if you're asking 10 or 15 people, yeah, can you go raise $10,000 for me? Because the reality is if you're going to run for like Superior Court, I think to be competitive in a race like this, you probably need to raise between $75,000 and $100,000 in King County. It's a nonpartisan race. You're asking other people to get you money. And then what are you spending that money on? Well, you know, there's like a 60% drop off between the top of the ticket and when you get to the judge races. Mm-hmm. So you got to make yourself known, and maybe you're buying a flyer or, you know, one of those mailers that you see. You know, those are about $40,000 for postage, for the graphics. You got to hire a campaign manager. You got to design a website. It's expensive, outcome uncertain, and lots of time away for your family. If you wanted to run statewide, like for one of the state Supreme Court seats, we'll multiply that by 39 counties. You're probably having to raise $1 million, and getting your name above the fray is super tough. Now you asked the question, how do you get to the bench? Well, you're right. There are two ways. You can be appointed, and that's by the governor if there is a vacancy. So someone retires or they die during office, the governor comes in and says, yeah, I'm going to make an appointment. Or you run. And there are two paths to run. You can run against an incumbent, or you run for an open seat. I ran for an open seat when I put in 10 years ago. Running against an incumbent is really hard because they're established. They have relationships with other judges. They have a network. And when you want to, if you are challenging an incumbent, that is an uphill road, even if you're a great lawyer. Like if you're a great lawyer and you know you believe in the issues and want to make a difference, it is still a very uphill road.
And so how is it those different, are the two. Do you think how is it different? Do you think for judges than it is for someone challenging an incumbent who's in the Senate or in Congress? Because I heard that from a judge last night too, who said that it is the system is he felt built to keep incumbents in their seats. Is there something, is it because you guys can't ask for money?
The money is part of it. But the other reality is when I'm running for, when a judge runs for a position or running for a justice position, what we can actually say is pretty limited. Like even in a political race, you can say, I'm going to be tough on crime or, I'm going to cure homelessness. When you're running for a judge, it's like, I've got an exceptionally well-qualified rating from the King County Bar Association. I believe in fairness and due process. I support the Constitution. And for voters, sometimes that's a nuance that like, okay, well, what have you really given me? I want to make the right choice when I vote, but we are constrained. I mean, I can't tell you today if I was running, let's say I was running for Supreme Court justice. I couldn't tell you how I was going to rule on cases. We're constrained to do that by the judicial code of conduct, our ethical responsibilities. So it's a very different flavor too. Not only are you trying to get above the fray of, all the political, the consumption of political oxygen by candidates with money and sizzle, but then when you do get to speak, it's pretty muted stuff. So that makes it hard. That makes it hard to, especially in the instance of when there's a race with an incumbent. Now, if you were to ask me, is it wrong that judges can't tell you how they would rule on cases? No, that's not wrong. We shouldn't be telling you how we would rule on cases.
Yeah. Same with the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, there those limitations exist for a reason. I know that can be frustrating to voters. But, you know, I think one of the reasons people are so surprised by this is, you know, you look at the most powerful positions in the country. I don't think it's the president. I think it's Supreme Court justices. You know, they serve those life terms. They make huge decisions that even presidents are bound by. And so when I look at and when other voters who've reached out to me look at the state Supreme Court and you look at some of the rulings they've made in recent years that have a profound impact on our state and on our lives, I think it's hard for people to look at the ballot for positions that are so critical and not see anyone else's name, not be given a choice at all.
Well, again, I mean, this, you know, you're asking one person. There are a lot of judges out there, and you probably would get different responses as to why there are not more challengers to incumbent judges or justices. I think for the reasons I've told you, that it's really hard. And people make that calculation, like, can I spend the time away from my family? Can I raise the money? Will I have the support so I have the noses in my column on election day? And a lot of folks weigh that and say, you know what? That is too much uncertainty. And they elect not to do it. And I can't say that it is unreasonable, given that landscape, for someone to make that decision.
Is there any or are there any changes to the system that you think would be helpful in making those races more competitive?
I mean, I suppose you could put the judicial races at the top of the ballot. No one would ever go for that, but that's one thing. You know, I also think people in your line of work can, like, for example, I love it that you're having this conversation about it, but media can put more time into who wants to be a judge and why. And that helps elevate the discussion. I mean, a lot of times people are just voting because they've seen the endorsement list in the Stranger or they see the endorsement list in the Seattle Times, and that's it. They don't know a lawyer. They can't call up their lawyer friend and say, who should I vote for? And people are really hesitant to make a bad decision when it comes to judges because of what I talked about earlier. Is like the scope, the breadth of the decisions that we make. I can tell someone, you know, when I issue a parenting plan, I'm telling someone when they're spending time with their kid. There's probably no more intimate involvement between government and the citizenry than something like that, right? But the amount of media attention on these races, and I get it, these aren't the races with sizzle. People aren't throwing, you know, there's not the insults. There's not the drama. These are sort of steady Eddie stuff. But the relative importance to the community, to society, to the rule of law is super high. So that's another thing, is more attention. Like what you're doing right here in our conversation, I'm really glad you're doing it. I'm glad that people are wondering what the heck.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, the implication, you know, people complain so much about the state of our judicial system or more largely our criminal justice system. And I understand the media's, you know, in a slight defense of the media, if a race is going unopposed, there's really no point to...
Like, what are you going to write on? Yeah, no, I totally understand that.
Yeah, so they need to... But I agree. I think more people who are interested in talking about these races might spur more people to run for them. I don't know if you can tell me, sitting there in that seat, but are you ever going to run for the Supreme Court?
That's a big decision. I'll tell you, I've thought about it. I've done a lot of the math that I've talked to you about today. It's a decision I'd have to make with my family. Today, I love what I do, and I don't have any plans to move on from being a trial judge. Plug for trial judges, this is where the action is. We get witnesses, we get evidence. The people are always interesting. People come into court, they've walked 1,000 miles to get there and to tell their story. And there's something that is really engaging and rewarding about that work, which is why I love what I do.
I want to end really quickly with an unrelated question. You've been very involved and outspoken in trying to improve safety around the courthouse for the people that work there, for the jurors who are coming in, expected to be there. How is that going?
Well, thanks for asking me that. And it is an issue that is really important to me. I'm super concerned. There was a plan that King County had put together with the city to take over City Hall Park, which is contiguous to the county courthouse. We've had a fence up there for 18 plus months. I have to tell you, I've been working at this building for almost 20 years now, and the fence going up is probably the single greatest thing that's helped the environment around here in terms of safety. Now, it doesn't do anything for people who want to use the park, obviously, because they can't go in there. And there has to be a right mix of safety and access to the park. But I'm concerned about what lies ahead. I appreciate the mayor making his request for funds. I'm not sure the city council has said that they're going to support it, but for jurors and for employees, they have to absolutely be able to ingress and egress this courthouse safely. And that'll be something I always speak up about because it's so important, because it's access to justice. You can't access justice if you can't access the building safely. So thanks for asking that. That's sort of where I am on what lies ahead.
Yeah, well, I was glad that you spoke out about it. Some other folks in the building spoke out about it just because it is so egregious. I mean, you go down there, it's like, I wouldn't want to go do jury duty. So I admire the people who do, but thank you for looking out for their safety and the safety of people that you work with. Your Honor, thank you for joining us on Undivided, and let us know if there's ever anything else you want to hop on to talk about.
Thanks for having me. Really nice to talk with you.
It's Friday. That means it's time for our segment, Florida Report.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Joining us is our Florida-based correspondent, my sister Miranda. Have you voted yet?
I have, actually.
Oh, who'd you vote for? No, you don't have to tell us. Don't tell us. As a matter of fact, don't tell us.
Okay.
We were going to like kind of do away with some of the fun Friday segments until the election is over, but there's so many interesting election things happening in Florida. And one of them is this brewing feud between Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis, which I find hilarious.
It is actually very hilarious. NBC 6 South, Trump holds rally in Miami with Rubio, but apparently not DeSantis. Trump will be at the Miami-Dade County Fair Expo Center on Sunday, and he'll be holding a rally. And he did not invite DeSantis, but he's there to, campaign behind Marco Rubio.
That's funny. And you know exactly what it is. I mean, Trump has this very fragile ego, and people really like Ron DeSantis. And I think Ron DeSantis has some of the same mannerisms as Trump, and Trump thinks that, like, it's stolen from him.
So. Yeah, and I think that also Trump takes a little bit of credit for DeSantis' success in 2018. And, but it always bothers me when people who formerly really supported each other start to, like, change tunes because suddenly they might go head-to-head in an election. Rather than just maybe trying it from another perspective and, like, using that to their advantage, the fact that they work really well together, and then kind of, like, pull yourself apart in a bonus way. Like, I do this too, rather than, like, completely turn your back on somebody that you just, like, really supported. It's just such a strange thing to me. And it's very unproductive. And both parties tend to do it.
Yeah, it's just petty and immature. And you're right. And actually, that's happening in the Washington Senate race here between Tiffany Smiley and Patty Murray. We pointed out both of them had really nice things to say about their work on veteran issues, like in 2018. Of course, they didn't know they were going to run against each other. And so, now they have these really, and I would say their attack ads, Tiffany's haven't been very personal. They've been on the issues, but there's been a lot of lies in Patty Murray's ads in particular, painting Tiffany Smiley as this really dangerous person. It's like, well, you said really nice things about her just a few years ago. So it's just,
yeah.
I think you're right. I think you can be like, hey, if you're Trump, I just go back to, I think Trump, sees anyone who's, even thinking about running against him as an enemy. And that's just how he operates. And so he could be like, yeah, I supported Ron, but, he's not the best person for the job. But that would be expecting too much.
He's going to have a hard time getting anybody that's like a supporter of DeSantis in Florida to really like look his way after the pandemic. Like, that really changed the way a lot of people perceive politicians, I think, in general. And they're pretty strong DeSantis fans down here. So I don't know how that'll play for him in his future running for president.
Yeah, Florida is a very important state for the presidency. And you were just telling me before we started that Hispanic voters, and we've talked about this, that Ron DeSantis could be the first Republican governor to win Miami-Dade County in like 30 years. Yeah. And you were telling me how a lot of registered Republicans, Hispanic registered Republicans in Miami-Dade County have already taken advantage of early voting at some pretty astounding numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, it's still early numbers, but Republicans are showing up at, or like registered Republicans are showing up early voting at 27%, where Democrats are at about 21%. We've been pretty deeply a blue city and county for a long time. So it's really interesting to see what's going to come out of Miami-Dade maybe flipping for the first time in a long time.
See, it doesn't really surprise me because like we've said, we've talked about your mayor a million times and he's a Republican. I don't think a lot of people look at him as a Republican because he's very, very moderate and he acts independently. He's been outspoken about some Republicans. If I recall, he's not a fan of Donald Trump. And so, yeah, I mean, they have it in them, but it's just interesting to see this county that is so heavily Hispanic come out in such force. And I've heard a lot of people opine that because I think Biden was in town to campaign for Charlie Crist a few days ago, right?
Yeah, he was. I got stuck in the traffic.
I was telling you, that's your fault. You need to watch the news more.
Apparently.
Yeah. And that's like right after he was here, that's when this early voting for Republicans really took off. I think it's going to be a blowout for Ron DeSantis in Florida.
I think so, too.
One of the things that does bother me is he was in this debate and he was asked what I think is a really legitimate question. And that's, are you committing to serving all 4 years? Clearly, he's not committing to serving all 4 years, but he just needs to like be more clear about that. Like, you know, I don't know what the future holds for me and I can't commit to that. Yeah. And I think people would understand, but he's sort of tiptoed around that issue in a way that I think isn't very sincere. Yeah. We didn't have you on last week because you were at a concert in Las Vegas. I'll show viewers of the video podcast a picture of you looking all goth. This was like what, emo music or what?
So this was the When We Were Young Festival. It was dozens of bands from back when in, you know, early 2000s, even late 90s, emo alternative rock music. And some of these bands haven't toured in 10, 15 years. And they got back together for this first time festival. So I had to go and it was actually really amazing and very emotional for me because I really loved some of these bands growing up. Like I knew every word to every song and it's been years. And I drove my boyfriend and his sister and her fiance along with us. And I think we enjoyed it. We got a little stuck in some mosh pits at one point, but it was an older crowd. It was like 35 to 40 year olds. But
first of all, that's not
fun.
That's not older. Okay.
It is for festivals because it was an all day festival and we were beat. Like I can't do festivals like that. So it was a little rough for the elder emos to be out there for so long.
Is that how you identify as an elder emo?
Yeah.
What was, like, name a band.
So the bands that I was really there to see was Hawthorne Heights, AFI, All American Rejects, Paramore, My Chemical Romance, ooh, Taking Back Sunday. Definitely some people in there that you guys would recognize, maybe just songs, maybe not the band names, but there's some bangers from back in the day. So it was really nostalgic and very fun. And they're doing it again next year. So jump in.
Yeah, I'll have to come. But since we didn't have you on, you had this great story ready. Because like you were all ready from Vegas to do Florida Report. And I was like, I woke up late. Let's just give you the week off. And so you had a good Halloween related story. And I was like, you know what? Let's do it this week anyway.
Look, zombies are not specifically related to Halloween anymore. These are a possible imminent future situation. So thankfully, Lawn Love, a lawn care company, did some research for us. And based off of the CDC's preparedness guide for zombies, they actually have one. They dug through a bunch of data and came up with the best cities and the worst cities in America to be in during a zombie apocalypse. And Florida had multiple cities at the top of the list for the best places to be. So they were voted we were voted the best state to be in for a zombie apocalypse, mainly because of the amount of hunting supplies. Apparently Miami and Fort Lauderdale have an extreme amount of hunting supply stores, which surprises me because we come from Minnesota and that is like hunter central. But, and then also it has something to do with coastal, being able to get onto a boat and get away and stuff like that. The weather, hospitals, et cetera. Portland, Oregon made it onto the top number four of best cities to be in. So that's kind of nice. Very far away. So you'll have to pick and choose if you want to come to Florida or stay up there in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, then, Portland, that doesn't surprise me.
No, and I'm actually surprised Washington wasn't on more of those lists. I feel like you guys probably have some bunkers that just aren't registered because they also took into consideration bunkers. And I'm assuming the CDC only knows about the ones with permits. So maybe you guys got some hidden bunkers out there that would put you higher up on the list. And just stay away from Nevada because that they had all the cities on the top five of the worst places were in Nevada. So don't go there.
Just something about maybe the deserts and landlocked and I don't know. But yeah, Washington, I think we have a lot of probably I think if you have a bunker, you probably don't register your bunker with any sort of government entity. But I also love the CDC just flat out. I'm such a curmudgeon wasting taxpayer dollars coming up with a freak survival guide for zombie apocalypse.
It's a waste until you need it, I guess. So hopefully we'll never need a zombie apocalypse prepared guide, but is one in case you need it.
I'm ready. I think you can come up here. We'll survive just fine. All right, Miranda, thank you.
You're welcome. Bye.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
That's it for today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Get those ballots in if you have not already. Remember, you have to get them in into a drop box by 8 p.m. on Election Day, which is Tuesday, or they can be postmarked by Election Day. But make sure if you're just dropping them in a USPS box that you know when the pickup time is. Because if you drop it in the box and those ballots don't get picked up from that mailbox that day, then your vote isn't going to count. So just make sure that you get it in. If you have not become an Undivided subscriber already, you can do that in two ways, at patreon.com/undivided, or by becoming a contributor on my locals community, brandycruz.locals.com. If you've enjoyed some of our election coverage, I would appreciate your support. You can become a subscriber for as little as $5 a month, and you get access to our bonus episodes for subscribers, which are every single Wednesday. Undivided is presented by our founding sponsor, 1530 Mortgage. You can visit them at 1530mortgage.com.